Hello and welcome to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. We're taking a break over the holidays, but whilst we're away, here is a treat that we've been saving up for you.
I'm here to put the meat in climate change, and warm glow in global warming, and are you mental in environmental? I have a PhD in climate change policy, which means I'm the sort of doctor that if you're ever on a flight and you have a heart attack, I will rush to your side, but only to berate you for flying.
Climate humour. Yes, it exists. And in a weird way, it is actually really cathartic. As you may have already guessed, the fact that I can bring you half an hour of climate jokes is thanks to our colleagues over at DW's Living Planet podcast. So without further ado, here is the broadcaster most likely to keep me calm in a permacrisis.
I'm Neil King, and in this episode of Living Planet, we're asking whether making the climate crisis the butt of jokes can make people rethink their ways. And who better to give us an insight than a comic slash scientist who didn't originally set out to be either?
My first career was actually, I came out of university and I worked for an investment bank.
Meet Matt Winning, a funny man from the Scottish town of Paisley, who describes his job, or one of them at least, as a bit of an oxymoron.
See, I'm an environmental economist. Environmental, yay, economist. Thanks. It's a bit like a human rights lawyer.
I did that for a year, and then I went and did a master's degree in economics. So my background was in law and economics. It's a very difficult word to say in a Scottish accent, law.
But even studying economics and law with an L didn't make climate science coupled with climate comedy an obvious next step.
So I didn't really know where I was necessarily going to go with my career, but things had sort of sparked my interest at university around climate change. I just found it really, really interesting.
So interesting, in fact, that he ended up doing a PhD in climate policy, which explains half of what he does now, but not all of it.
And then about 9 months into my PhD, I realised I really needed to be out of the house every evening doing a hobby, and I started a stand-up comedy course at the university.
He didn't start off by making climate comedy his comedy target, and yet, in fact, already had been delivering other less scientific routines for several years before he made the shift. That was almost a decade ago. The Paris Agreement had just been signed, and the warming of our world was making big headlines. So taking rising temperatures onto the stage would be tapping into some kind of zeitgeist. But knowing climate was a hard sell, Matt had a healthy dose of doubt.
And I thought, well, I guess I know a lot about climate change. This is what I spend every day of my life thinking about and working on. But nobody wants to hear about climate change. You know, that was my viewpoint. Even, back then I was like, wow, that's not going to work though. Nobody's going to actually want to hear about climate change. And also, how are you going to make that funny?
Which is something many people, including myself, might be wondering. Because the impacts of rising global temperatures are so widespread and so serious that it's hard to imagine it could even have a funny side.
But the more I thought about it, the more I was like, well, I might as well give it a try.
Now, people say, okay, so it's happening. Yeah, but maybe it's something else. Maybe it's natural factors. Well, actually, no. We know basically all of the other natural factors that would influence climate change, things like the sun or volcanoes, would have ever so slightly cooled the planet over the last 150 years. So humans are actually causing about 110% of climate change. People say you can't give 110%. It turns out you can. Stop doing it.
The first 3 months it was the hardest 3 months of anything I've ever done because I was dying on stage. People hated it at first because I I don't know what I'm, you know, I'm just trying, I'm floundering about trying to figure out how to do this. And I would just keep going back up on stage. I had a presentation. I was like, these are the things I'm going to talk about. I'm going to try and make them funny.
Anyway, so we're going to go through a recap of kind of the science and impacts, some stuff about psychology, individual action, and then finally we'll have a summary. And I know what you're thinking, in the future with climate change, won't every day be summary?
No.
And at first, you know, people were amused by this sort of the persistence of it, where I was like, I'm going to be talking for an hour here. And it's going to be about climate change. People found that sort of amusing in itself. But that only gets you so far.
Since the 1900s, we've increased our use of fossil fuels about 8 or 9 times. And that is mostly coming from coal, gas and oil, which was actually the original name of the band Earth, Wind and Fire. And a lot of the older professors, that's their favourite.
Matt spent months redefining his onstage persona and writing enough material to put together that he was happy with. And then he took the show to the annual month-long Fringe Festival in the Scottish city of Edinburgh for a baptism of fire in the shape of 25 performances.
Now, people often ask me when I do this, they say, what can we do about it? And it's difficult as a member of the public to know what you're supposed to do about climate change. You're told lots of confusing things, aren't you? You're told to recycle more, change your light bulbs, go back in time and kill yourself before you were born.
By the time the month was over, Matt hadn't bombed or been heckled off the stage. Instead, he'd actually found that audiences were both interested and engaged. It was the confirmation he needed to keep going.
People kept saying, you know, afterwards, oh, I thought I was going to hate that, but it was really informative. You know, I felt like I learned something, and it was real, you know, and I laughed.
Which might sound unlikely given the serious and widespread impacts of rising global temperatures. So how did he set about extracting humour from something so earnest?
I found it really difficult. And what I did was I ended up going and talking to other comedian friends of mine who have nothing to do with climate change, and just talking through, you know, some of the topics, whatever it was, you know, either some of the impacts, heat waves and other things like that, as well as, you know, sea level rise, but also talking about solutions around electric vehicles, whatever it is.
Max Boykoff, who chairs the Environmental Studies Program at the University of Colorado Boulder, says humour, by its very nature, offers a different way into difficult issues and another way to understand the world we live in.
Comedy has the power to help us find common ground together. And in these high stakes, high profile, highly politicized challenges, you know, where climate change has the potential to overwhelm everyday people, humorous treatments can lower those defenses, can open us up, increase accessibility to complex, often distant dimensions of climate change just by making them relatable. Also, the live shows have great value because that collective participation is really important. We don't feel so isolated, that we feel that we're relating to each other on what's funny.
He says climate stand-up is not only about poking fun at what governments or societies could be doing better. It can also be a way of talking about what is going right and the part people might be able to play in positive action.
An additional piece of all this is that with comedy, you know, we can think about the various ways that make us laugh. But we had added this layer of engaging with climate change content and pointing towards solutions as well. And so we, over time, had been working with comedians and working with our students to point towards spaces where our students could talk about solutions and talk about actions to alleviate the negative impacts of climate change.
So I thought about, well, what's the environmental impact of coffee? So it turns out that if you have a white coffee, just a splash of milk in your coffee, you double the emissions associated with that coffee. And if you have a latte, yeah, because you're a big baby, you need a big glass of warm milk.
One of Matt's shows is built around the smaller and bigger ways he could reduce his emissions footprint enough to feel okay about becoming a father, something he explains he always knew he wanted.
A wise person once said, I believe the children are our future. A climate scientist? No. Whitney Houston. And I agree with Whitney, but also think, it depends on what kind of a child you have. right? If I have a vegan clever child who, you know, somehow invents the world's first zero carbon airline, yeah, they're already offsetting themselves. So I guess the point of what I'm trying to say is the point of this show is don't have too many children. Right. But also you don't have to have no children. Just have better children.
As a father himself, he weaves elements of his family life into his routines. But he also acknowledges how hard it can sometimes be to find the levity in a subject that touches his life and the decisions he makes, in the same way it touches those of billions of others.
And it's quite, I don't know, cold-blooded. It's quite heartless. You almost have to, I have to really disconnect a part of my personality to be able to view it in a lens that's just purely about writing jokes. It is such a sort of split personality that I've had to approach this with.
The way you described that there with the split personality bit, I think that's quite an interesting analogy to how we are as humans in the climate crisis, because every day, I mean, we all do it. We do stuff that's bad for the climate. And then we try and do things that don't harm the climate so much, or we try and invest in things that, you know, are positive. But this cognitive dissonance that's going on the time, it's like an undercurrent that nobody's can get out of. And sometimes we just try and ignore it or not think about it. But you're going right into that current each time, right?
The cognitive dissonance around climate is so enormous, really, and almost necessary as a way of survival. I mean, we saw with, like, you know, with COVID and the pandemic as well, we had to find ways of coping then, and that was a very short, you know, amount of time comparatively to what we're dealing with climate change here, which is obviously the entire, you know, globe slowly changing over our entire lifetimes and becoming more dangerous. So we have to find ways to cope. I think I've sat with it enough, obviously, that I sort of know when I'm doing it and I can decide when to do it and when not to do it.
It's tough being German. People think I'm punctual, but I'm often late. Let's do a quick check of stereotypes. When you think of Germany, you think of extreme punctuality, perfect planning, high-tech and efficiency. Well, think again. Welcome to Delayland, a podcast about a country that needs your help. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Part of Matt's aim is to deliver the information in ways that help break through that cognitive dissonance, to offer a level of clarity that can prompt others to make climate-positive decisions. But for all the comedy bells and whistles, the facts underneath have to stand up to scientific scrutiny. Each crack, he says, is triple-checked for accuracy. So much so that when he's writing a show, he starts by drafting a public lecture on climate change and then goes back and packs it full of jibes and jabs, be it about his self-proclaimed hatred for SUVs, how the hardest part of trying going vegan in January was calling it Veganuary without wanting to punch himself in the face, and of course, flying.
A return flight from London to New York, right, so there and back, is the equivalent emissions of you having to go vegan for 2 years to offset that, right? So, like, and it's the equivalent of, the only way of offsetting that, you know, sort of the equivalent emissions saving would be to do all of your recycling for 5 years for that one return flight to New York. So, you know, people just don't, I don't think, quite grasp the magnitude of what causes more problems than others. And it's a very, you know, it's a very Western decadent thing to do. Most people that have ever existed on the planet haven't stepped foot on an airplane. So it's a tricky one. Now, I've come up with a solution. Right, hear me out. this is my solution, because we need to sort of reduce demand, stop people flying. Right? Some people are afraid of flying. I think we just need to make more people afraid of flying. I'm thinking glass floors on planes. Actual snakes in a plane. Only in-flight entertainment is the film Alive. Babies crying across the entire plane. How do we get them to cry? We're blowing smoke in their face, are you?
Matt is always looking to hit a rhythm between jokes and facts, between getting people to crease up laughing and sit up and listen. The ratios vary from show to show and person to person. But Max Boykoff says his research into the effectiveness of creative climate communication, such as comedy, reveals positive results.
When we've been surveying the audiences that have come to the shows, they have given us feedback that comedy is helping enhance their awareness, their feelings of moving from paralysis to feelings of action, that it's helped dislodge that feeling of anxiety and a movement towards engagement and problem solving. And it's increased the salience of climate change and the connections to many other activities and facets of our lives. And so that's consistently been what we've been hearing from audiences.
But who are those audiences? Matt says people often suggest he is probably preaching to the converted rather than tickling a whole new congregation.
It's weird that, because clearly I'm not a preacher. I'm just a guy standing on stage. And it just so happens that when I come and talk to people, they sort of gather around my feet. Learn from the wisdom. I mean, I'm not saying I'm Jesus. I'm 33 and I'm trying to save the world. I've got a beard, love Easter eggs. I've got 12 friends and I don't trust one of them. And if I'm honest, my dad is quite controlling. He does nothing on a Sunday.
Climate protest actions and the backlash against them, both societally and in some cases legally, might suggest that there is a clear divide between those who do and do not care about the climate, with not much in between. But research suggests that is not the full picture, and that the public is split into six different groups: alarmed, concerned, cautious, disengaged, doubtful, dismissive, with most people somewhere in the middle.
I won't go into detail too much, but basically I dismay the idea that people are either converted or skeptics. And those people are very much either end of the spectrum. And what you have in between that is about 50% of the public or more who think it's an issue but aren't really engaging with it. And that's who I am targeting. That's who I'm trying to write the comedy shows for, is this sort of like, how do you engage the people in the middle who go, you know, I think this is an issue, but we've got these other problems, whatever it is, and we should focus on them a little bit more, or well, maybe climate change isn't as immediate an issue as something else.
Most people are in this concern, but I had a guy, someone the other day when I asked them about it, and they said they were concerned. And I said, what's stopping you becoming alarmed? And he said, it sounds exhausting. Very much. But yeah, so it's talking to these people. Now, there's a reason why 75% of people in here, a number of reasons. One is that climate change is very distant to all of us, right? It's always like in the future, it's going to happen far away, or people far away, or it's happening to polar bears. Right? I don't know about how you, do any of you hang out with polar bears? I mean, I do. It's the one friend I don't trust. Very differing views on a number of issues. You could say that we are bear opposites.
For Matt, pretty much anything is fair game, if it can be made funny.
The problem I have is when I'm like, how do I explain the concept of stranded oil and gas assets in a really funny way? Like, can I do, like, the setup is too complicated and requires too much information to make the jokes worth it. That's the hard parts. That's, to be honest, that's the main thing where I'm like, I'd like to talk about this topic and I think it's an important topic, but I really struggle to make it as engaging as I would like. And that's going to take me time. Occasionally I can put something that's heavy, much heavier or difficult to talk about towards the end of the show where it doesn't need as much in the way of comedy and it won't have a punchline at the end of it.
Which is not to say the end of his shows spiral into pure doom and gloom. The comedy heart beats too hard for that. But the whole thing is a balancing act, educational and entertaining, honest and humorous, academic and amusing. He hopes that by the end of it, people will go home with a new level of knowledge and feeling about the scale of the problem, and an understanding that everyone can make a contribution toward positive change. Leading by example, all the way.
I have cut down my dairy, though. Dairy's right down. I now only drink oat milk, which is really weird when I have it on my porridge every single morning, because it feels like I'm the most Scottish man in the entire world. I can't get enough oats. I need someone to ground them down and pour them my oats for me. I didn't actually realise this until quite recently. I watched a Netflix documentary about how they make oat milk, and I hadn't realised that they actually they separate the oats, the mothers from the children, at quite a young age, and then they keep the mothers pregnant, and that's porridge. That's a weird bit, isn't it?
And in the very best of scenarios, there might even be audience members who feel motivated to get started on doing something constructive themselves.
Engage, but engage in whatever way you feel comfortable engaging in. You don't feel like you have to engage in a way that other people do. Find your own path. And, you know, and I talk about how I do this and how, and the impact that I have from going on stage and talking about it. And that's just because I was really, you know, I love doing comedy, and I found something that was my thing that I could then go out and do. So just, you know, even if it's small, even whatever it is in your community, try and do something, try and engage with other people, try and think of this as a bigger problem that makes you to engage with community and be part of something, because otherwise we'll never actually solve this in time.
Two questions he says he gets asked a lot are whether there is still hope and what we can do about it.
Basically, people want me to say, either say yes or screwed, so that they, you know, don't have to do anything about it. Or they want me to say no, it's fine, so they don't have to do anything about it. The answer is neither of those things. The answer is that we're somewhere in the middle. The other question, you know, what can I do about it, is we actually need to do stuff about it because of that. You know, we're not screwed, but only if we do stuff about it.
Matt believes the global community will have solved climate change by the end of the century, in the sense that emissions will have been reduced to the point they need to be at. But he questions whether it will be a last-minute dash that will cause greater levels of suffering to life on Earth between now and then, or whether the world will get its act together sooner rather than later and make use of the solutions out there. That part of the story has not yet been written. But he hopes that spreading the word through creative humour plays its part in getting the message to places that are otherwise hard to reach.
I'll just keep getting out there and keep talking to people about it, and hopefully slowly make my small piece of a difference that may well cascade in ways that I can't foresee. You know, yeah. I might do something, inspire somebody that goes and does something much more impactful than I could ever do. And if I do that, then great. I'm very happy to play a role in where humanity's heading. I think that's the main thing that kind of gets me up every day. I can see where we have to get to, and I'm happy to play whatever role I can on pushing us there.
My thanks to presenter and editor Neil King, producer Tamazin Walker, and sound engineer Moritz Vogt for permission to bring you that most chucklesome of living planets. More episodes, although admittedly none quite like that one, wherever you get your podcasts. We will be back with normal Inside Europe programming next week. Welcome back to Inside Europe, the weekly current affairs podcast and radio programme from DW, Germany's international broadcaster. For the next half hour, we are going global. That is because we are handing the second half of the show over to our colleagues, Carolyn Bieler and Marco Warman, for a special edition of GBH's The World. It's all about transportation, and we hope that you'll stick around for the ride. But hold on tight, because things are about to pick up speed.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Bieler. When you step onto a bus or a train, you often hear a recorded voice telling you which route you're on, where it's going, and what stop is next. Sometimes that voice is robotic and cold. Sometimes it is warm and reassuring.
In Japan, regular riders of the bullet train rely on a voice that is most certainly not robotic. Last winter, our transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel went to Kyoto and met the person behind the 200-mile-per-hour voice.
When you first board the Tokaido Shinkansen, the bullet train as it's commonly known, you hear two voices. First, an announcement in Japanese. And then one in English.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Shinkansen.
That second voice has become the subject of fascination for locals and travelers from around the world, with Reddit threads about her smooth and calming tone. One commenter writes, "The first time I heard it, it made me want to meet her so we could discuss global politics or Wittgenstein."
You are welcome to put your luggage on the overhead shelf.
Well, I did meet her.
I'm Donna Burke, and I am a voice actor and a singer, but I'm most famous for doing the voice on the Shinkansen.
We find each other at a crowded cafe in the Tokyo neighborhood of Nakano, where she lives. We don't talk politics or Austrian philosophy, but I do hear the unlikely story of how an Australian expat became the British-accented voice of the most famous train in the world. A story that begins with a classic hymn.
Amazing grace.
When Donna Burke first moved to Japan nearly 30 years ago, she tells me, she started out as a wedding singer. And while Amazing Grace might be more associated with funerals in America and Australia, it was a hit at Japanese weddings.
They loved having Amazing Grace sung by a foreign singer, which denoted that they were sophisticated, cultured, they had money. It was romance, it was class.
And for Donna, it was an opportunity. She did six weddings a day, making $300 each. She got representation, got gigs singing for TV commercials, and eventually landed gigs voicing and singing for video games, including Metal Gear Solid, Silent Hill, and Final Fantasy. And along with all of that success came more success. As Donna puts it, she was in the right place at the right time. It was the 90s and early 2000s, and more difficult to outsource English language singers and voice actors through the internet. And Donna was here in Japan. Another stroke of luck came in 2004, when the woman who previously did the bullet train announcements, a Canadian, was moving away. JR Central, the company that operates the bullet train, wanted a permanent resident. So they had Donna try out, and they wanted her to sound just like the person who used to do it, who they also had sound just like the person who did it before her, a woman with a calming English accent.
I'm Australian, mimicking a Canadian who was mimicking a British woman who was the original voice on the Shinkansen.
And if Donna is anything...
Welcome to the Shinkansen.
She is a great mimic.
This is an Nozomi Super Express bound for Shin Osaka Station.
She got the job and has been doing it for the past 20 years. Yet despite being heard by people all around the country, because she's putting on an act, nobody really knows it's her.
No one ever stops me and says, "You sound exactly like..." Because if I did, Jeremy, I'd be talking like this in a very motherly voice with a...
quite a smile, not too much of a smile, but a smile nonetheless. And it's very calming. And that's not who I am in real life.
As I get off my train from Kyoto, I meet Susie and Jim McQuillan, who are visiting from Perth with their three children. They're stoked to have taken their first bullet train ride together, and even more excited to learn that even though Donna sounds just like a Brit, she's one of their own.
I think the bullet train's awesome. Much better than plane.
Very nice way to travel.
Did you notice the voice during it saying, like, you are now arriving? Did you know that she's an Australian?
Oh, really? No! No!
Susie, who speaks Japanese, gets a little inspired after I tell her Donna's story.
I want a job as the person that translates and announces the stuff. So I need to impersonate the person who's impersonating the person who's impersonating the original. I can do that. I can do that.
But if you ask Donna, she has no plans to give up her job as the most famous voice that nobody knows anytime soon. For The World, Jeremy Siegel, Kyoto.
In Barcelona, city planners have set aside big chunks of downtown to give foot traffic priority over cars. These areas are known as super islands. Pedestrians and neighborhood residents love them. Drivers, not so much. The World's Jerry Haddon hit the streets for this story back in May.
It's Ivan Ferreira's day off. The 28-year-old sushi chef reclines on a long wooden lounger, reading a book, barefoot in the sunshine, in the middle of a major downtown intersection. In most parts of the city, this would get you run over. But this is a super island. I usually go to the beach, he says, but sometimes I don't have the time, so I come here. It's great. There are bars and cafes all around and lots of trees, he says, and it all generates a feeling of calm. There are benches and chairs of all sorts to sit on and big planters with flowers and bushes. What makes this a super island, though, is that it's not just one intersection. They come in clusters of up to nine, all contiguous, connected by pedestrian priority roads. An island is an escape, says Carmen Jimenez, a fashion industry exec. She's answering texts and drinking a coffee on a nearby bench surrounded by flowers. You go to an island to get away from your usual surroundings, she says. They're trying to achieve that feeling with these super islands, she says, but they're not there yet. Because this is, after all, still a busy, bustling city. Cars aren't banned on these islands, but if you do drive in, you end up feeling like you've made a wrong turn.
Okay, I am turning into a super island with the hopes of taking a shortcut to get to the other side of this neighborhood. And I will fail, because as my friend Alex puts it, landing on a super island is like when you're playing a board game and you're trying to advance squares. Land on a super island, it sets you back one.
You can't just cut across them. The narrow lanes for cars are all set up as one-way streets that keep forcing you left or right. So you basically end up dumped out where you started.
And I'm driving at about 6 miles per hour. If this were night, the rats would be passing me.
As for my friend Alex, his full name is Alex Fernandez Camps. He's a well-known designer of bicycles and was also an early advisor to the city on the super islands. You don't need to be an expert in urban planning to see how these work, he tells me. All you need to do is watch. We're sitting at the center of yet another island intersection. Next to us, kids are playing. I see 5 people roll past in wheelchairs, seemingly unworried for their safety. The few cars that do come in, like I did, move in slow motion along the periphery. It's not about prohibiting cars, Fernandez says. It's about ensuring that driving here is inefficient. The essence of this project, he says, isn't the outdoor furniture or adding more bike lanes. It's about restricting the flow of motorized vehicles. Because, he says, they kill through accidents, but also from the pollution they generate and even the noise. Check out the sonic contrast between off-island and on.
Off-island. On-island.
The city has 9 super islands done or underway. It wants dozens, if not hundreds, more. Again, Alex Fernandez.
El respaldo social es difícil porque suele ser...
People are reluctant when you introduce change, he says, but a lot of the people who are really against these islands, especially business owners who feared less traffic, they've come around. Like Tony Roach, who owns an on-island fruit and vegetable store. I was skeptical, he says, because we have to load and unload merchandise and you're not allowed to park in here. But they told us, if you're a business owner, you won't have any problems. And we don't. Besides, he says, now when he looks out the front door, he sees green and people hanging out. Before, all he could see were cars and trucks double-parked everywhere. Now, one of the few cars I see is a taxi. Driver Carlos Delgado has just dropped off some annoyed passengers. He says they accused him of taking a circuitous route to run up the meter.
Sí, porque uno tiene que decirle que hay ciertas calles que no puedes ingresar.
I have to explain to my clients that there are certain streets around here where you really can't enter, he says. You have to go all the way around, then circle back, etc. You used to be able to get to your destination much faster, he says, and clients don't like it. And that, he says, means customers are less likely to flag him down, opting instead to walk, which, if you're on a super island, is a joy for many. But opposition to the islands remains strong in some corners. In 2023, a group of business owners sued to have Barcelona's largest super island removed, arguing that it snarled downtown traffic. A judge agreed, ruling that the city did not follow proper planning procedures in creating the island. The case could take years to resolve. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Getting a car through some parts of La Paz, Bolivia? Good luck with all that, not because of zoning, but because of the city's extreme topography. It sits way up in the Andes Mountains, nestled in a bowl-shaped depression on a plateau. So not just any kind of transit can work there. As Michael Fox reported from La Paz last spring, a cable car system has transformed how people get around.
1.5 hours. That's how long it used to take Juan Carlos Plata to go to and from work along the winding, car-choked streets of La Paz. Now, 11 minutes. It's been really good for us. It's incredible, he says. It's calm. No one bothers you. You couldn't expect anything like this before. The cable car, or teleférico as it's known here, was a pipe dream for years. But then, with the financial boom of the late 2000s and early 2010s, then-President Evo Morales made it a priority. It was inaugurated in 2014. 200,000 people use it each day. You've seen the geography of La Paz, says José Victor Choque, who rides the cable car frequently. Mountains, up and down. So to have a direct mode of transportation, it's beneficial for everyone. It really saves time. And the price is right. 3 bolivianos, or about 30 cents. I spent a pair of days riding up and down across the city. I'll be honest, I had expected long wait times, like you see for gondola rides at ski resorts. There was none of that. There are lines during rush hour, but they move quickly. A new car leaves the station every 12 seconds. That translates into roughly 50 people a minute.
I'm on the, heading onto the orange line right now. There's a couple people in front of me. And I'm getting on.
Everyone sits. The doors close. Seconds later, the car speeds up and out of the station. In some of the cars, people talk softly. In one of the rides I took, someone was FaceTiming. But most, everyone's quiet. It's almost like a place of meditation or reflection. Flying high over the busy streets and mass of cinder block homes, you can hear the sounds of the city, but they're muffled by the distance and the glass. The cable car is also really practical, says Ibi, who only gave her first name before running to catch a ride. When there are protests and roadblocks, it used to be a huge problem, she says. Now, we just fly over them. Protests aren't the only thing the cable cars help people get around. The streets of La Paz flood often in the rainy season, which stretches from November into April. 1 half-hour downpour in late January overflowed worn-out sewage systems, choking traffic, and sending water shooting up from manholes. The cable cars and their passengers rolled on like nothing happened.
Amo mi teleférico. Sí.
I love my cable car, says lawyer Olivia Espejo, who uses it to travel back and forth from work each day. For example, right now it's raining, and you would never find a minibus on the street, she says. Instead, the cable car continues to run. That's a huge benefit. I am very happy, she says. Is there a negative to La Paz's cable car system? Anthropologist Carlos Revilla says yes.
Pero aquí fue carísimo, ¿no? Fue carísimo y se hizo, digamos, un poco a toda
It was costa. Really expensive, he says. The costs were way over budget, and they had to raise some properties to build it. But on the other hand, says Revilla, something else happened that was totally unexpected. It's been breaking down walls in the city between the rich and the poor. Working class people from El Alto can go to the malls, he says. Upper class people from the southern region can go to the July 16th market and feel safe. So there's been this beautiful process of rupturing urban segregation, he says. In a country where everyone is divided over politics, the cable car is just about the one thing everyone can agree on.
Por suerte, no.
Es increíble.
Luckily, I don't know anyone that doesn't like the cable car, says 17-year-old high school student Ignacio Crespo.
Me siento muy bien de que en la ciudad en la que yo vivo podamos disfrutar.
He says it feels good that in the city where he lives, he can enjoy the longest cable car in the world. It's not new technology, he says, but it's innovative and helpful on so many occasions. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, La Paz, Bolivia.
It is a sporting event I can't believe many people were asking for, but it happened.
Wow, now look at the crowds. Look at the crowd.
Vienna hosted the first ever World Tram Driver Championship in September. That racket was captured by the official live stream on YouTube.
Teams of tram drivers representing 25 different countries competed while thousands of spectators lined the streets.
Some of the tram driving challenges were pretty straightforward, stopping, accelerating, and backing up smoothly. Others were a little more fun, like steering with a bowl of water attached to the front of a streetcar and trying not to spill it, or tram curling, pushing a smaller trolley and making it stop on a target.
Goodness. This is really, really exciting. This is such a tight race right in the moment.
The competition was neck and neck right to the end. Home team Austria knocked down every pin but one in tram bowling. You can use your imagination, which set up Poland to snag the title in tram curling. But no, their drivers failed to take the lead.
Austria is the champion. Austria is the first winner of the World Cup. The host of the first World Cup gets the title. They got it. Now look at that.
The head of Austria's team said he was overwhelmed and speechless after winning in his native country. No mention of a home team advantage. Maybe next year will be Poland's time to shine with the second annual World Tram Driver Championship slated for Warsaw.
You're listening to The World.
The World is supported by StoryWorth. Each week, StoryWorth emails a loved one a question about their life. After a year, StoryWorth will publish their stories and color photos into a book to keep for generations. Learn more at StoryWorth.com. And by BetterHelp, committed to making mental health well-being a priority and offering support in taking on everything life demands, with therapists available to communicate via video, chat, or phone at BetterHelp.com/public.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We're spending this Thanksgiving Day telling stories of transit in solidarity with all the folks who made fast trips to be with friends and family.
But there is another way to travel, slowly, very slowly. Friend of the show, Paul Salopek, is a slow travel expert. He's a National Geographic explorer who has been walking around the planet pretty much nonstop for 12 years.
And because he's exploring the Earth at the speed of his feet, he's able to get off the beaten path and relish the luxury of the unexpected. So Paul gets to see stuff you might miss if you travel by car, plane, or rail, like one desert village he visited in Ethiopia.
Dalifag is a pastoralist kind of resupply center. The local people around there were camel and goat shepherds. And I was going there basically for the water, because I knew it had a well. And I had in my mind that this would be kind of a fairly rustic outpost, maybe with a little shop that I could buy some noodles and whatnot. But what I found out is that it was crammed with pastoral nomads. And the reason was, it wasn't just offering water, it was offering electricity for them to recharge their mobile phones.
And your picture of what that looks like is pretty extraordinary. It's not cattle pulling up to a watering hole when we're looking at USB and lightning connections.
It was pretty remarkable, because what I was expecting was kind of a well with camels around it and guys bucketing out water using, you know, skin buckets. There was that. But what I saw instead were shops that had these rows and rows of wires with chargers on them. And these nomads were coming in, giving the shop owner their phone. He was plugging them in for several hours. The shepherds kind of sat by and had a tea waiting for their phones to charge. I met one guy, and these pastoralists, you know, they're dressed traditionally. They're wearing kind of a sarong-like wrap. They have a big knife stuck in their belt. He had his wrap filled up with dozens of mobile phones that he'd gathered from his neighbors to come walk into this electronic oasis to recharge.
How do mobile phones fit into what sounds like, you know, this pastoralist traditional nomadic life?
For them, you know, having a mobile phone, even if you're pushing camels around the Rift Valley of Africa, is mighty handy, because before you had communications, and we're talking maybe just, you know, a generation ago, fairly recently, you were at the mercy of middlemen who were going to buy your animals at whatever price they determined. The mobile phone has given these pastoralists an amazing, powerful tool to actually find other bidders. So it's given them great economic power.
So another surprise, at least for me, was what you found in a suburb of Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia. You take us into this unlikely area with grungy auto repair shops, and you get to this tunnel that takes visitors 40 feet underground and more than 100 years into the past. What's in the secret chamber at the end of the tunnel?
Well, what some people don't know, I mean, Georgia used to be under the Soviet Union, of course, is that one of the great dictators, one of the big strongmen of the Soviet Union, one of the guys who killed a lot of people, right, was Stalin. He was Georgian. So to my astonishment, I found that there was this house near the Mtvari River in the city of Tbilisi that had a supposed relic of his printing press, right, where he was involved as a young revolutionary, printing out anti-imperial tracts, leaflets, what have you. And so at the bottom of this tunnel, at this vertical hole, was, you know, a century-old printing press.
I mean, as you say, Joseph Stalin is so associated with the Soviet Union, we forget that he had this earlier life as a native of Georgia. I mean, he was printing out revolutionary tracts. What else was he doing in his youth there?
Well, you know, Stalin comes from a very poor family, a shoemaker. He wanted to join the priesthood. He wanted to be a poet. Those frustrations, plus the revolutionary fervor that was bubbling up in the Caucasus at the time, got him immersed into basically Bolshevik radical activity. And part of that process, he became a criminal. He was a bank robber. He started knocking off banks, and he went in and out of prison. He was very good at escaping from prison. He'd be put in jail, and a few weeks later, he had escaped out to rob another bank to fund his revolution.
The museum curator there, he's also a real character. What's his story?
Yeah, old Soso. I mean, here was kind of a middle-aged Georgian guy. And keep in mind, you know, when I walked through Georgia, they were about 20 years or so out of being under the Iron Curtain. And everybody was very happy to kind of be independent, having their freedom. But Soso was kind of a throwback, what Georgians would call homo sovieticus, somebody who looked back with nostalgia on the Soviet period because he had been sidelined economically with the advent of pro-Western democracy, capitalism. He was basically living, Marco, at the museum. The museum was kind of his house. And he claimed to be a former KGB agent very proudly when he discovered that I was American. He showed me a KGB card, which was a bit suspicious because it was printed in English.
Wow. So one last stop, and this one is more recent. When you walk through Western China in 2022, you describe walking through dense forests, and you come upon a farmhouse, and the walls were covered with artwork, huge murals showing an astronaut, a Mars lander, a UFO, solar systems, constellations. What is this place?
Not just one farmhouse, but Marco, an entire village. So yes, the whole village had this very bizarre cosmic motif going on, which was very mysterious.
What did residents in this village have to say about space exploration?
I interviewed three people saying, you know, what's going on? Why is this kind of like the Smithsonian Institute's space flight wing in rural Yunnan, except on farmers' houses?
Right.
They said, you know, some guy showed up in a van one day and said, can I paint some stuff on your houses for free? And we said, sure, why not? They could use a coat of paint. And he painted these astronauts floating on tethers out in orbit, the rings of Saturn, in vibrant, vivid color. And as it turns out, apparently a businessman from an eastern city in China had come to this place. He was an amateur astronomer. He noticed how dark the sky was in this part of rural Yunnan and decided to buy a local school building that was abandoned because, you know, people are leaving the countryside in China and moving to the cities. He bought it for cheap, converted it into a guest house, and tried to start a business of kind of touristic astronomy, inviting in amateur astronomers to come look at the sky over this town called Gomigu. And that was his dream. So he basically implanted his dream on this entire village, which, by the way, its main product was potatoes.
Well, Paul, we've only highlighted a few of the unusual spots you've come across on your walk. I'm guessing there are many, many more. I'm curious, though, what does the element of surprise play in a walking trip like yours?
Yeah, well, that's kind of a recurring theme in my life and in my writing, is that surprise, serendipity is crucial to this project. I mean, very little is planned. All these places that we just, you know, marveled over were accidents. This is an accidental story project where we find stories along the trail, not expecting what's happening next in the next day.
National Geographic explorer Paul Salopek writes and photographs as he travels on foot around the globe. You can follow along at outofedenwalk.nationalgeographic.org and at our website, theworld.org. Paul, thank you very much, as always.
Marco, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Whether your travels this weekend are slow or fast, down the street or across the country, we wish you a very pleasant holiday. The World is produced by GBH and PRX. We broadcast weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace.
You've been listening to the second part of a transportation special recorded by our colleagues over at GBH's The World, hosted by Carolyn Beeler and Marco Warman. Part one is also available on their podcast feed, and there has never been a more crucial time to start supporting US public media. So if you do go back and look for that, please do consider subscribing to them. We will be back with normal programming next week. In the meantime, on behalf of the Inside Europe team, we would like to wish you a very happy new year and to thank you also very much for listening. Inside Europe was pre-produced by Laura Kabelka and me, Kate Laycock, and our sound engineer was Ziad Abu Sleiman. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn.